I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
It'd be funny if it weren't so pathetic. No, what the heck, I'll laugh anyway.
Do you ever find yourself asking,
has the planet gone mad?
As you stare into the abyss, and the abyss gives you a case of the giggles. Well, you're not alone. On this edition of Parallax Views, comedian Jake Flores of the Pod Damn America and the Why You Mad podcasts joins us to untangle the surrealist tragic comedy of politics in the year 2020. And yes, we do talk about the time that Jake got visited by Homeland Security for tweeting a joke about ICE. Yes, you heard that right. In addition, we also discuss how Jake got into comedy, his experiences in the world of stand-up, including opening for the legendary Doug Stanhope, and a completely unplanned, impromptu discussion about the similarities between the genres of horror, my favorite genre, and comedy. Hell, we even talk about what it's like to interview John McAfee. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Jake Flores of Pod Damn America and the Why You Mad podcast. Welcome to Parallax Views, Jake Flores of Pod Damn America, also a great stand-up comedian. How are you doing, Jake, in quarantine in Corona Land, as I'm calling this moment in our illustrious history?
I like that the moment is called a land. That's cool, as the name of a space. I'm fine. I'm in Brooklyn, which is a bad place to be, but I'm inside, which is a good place to be. So, you know, not bad relatively, I guess. It could be worse, I guess, is what my whole take on the quarantine right now.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I guess the people that I feel something for is everyone in, you know, Brooklyn and people I know in, like, the bigger cities. I'm here in, like, Pittsburgh. I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you was, how did you get into comedy?
Let me see. I liked comedy a lot when I was a kid. I definitely had that, you know, got into my brain in my formative years. I used to watch a lot of, like, Nick at Night and Comedy Central and shit like that growing up. You know, became a child that would grow up into someone who wants to be a TV writer, you know. There's weird children across the world that watch Dick Van Dyke when they're kids and sort of grow up with the language of old sitcoms in their head.
Oh my God, I thought I was the only person because my mom used to watch all those old shows. Anything with Dick Van Dyke she would watch. So I grew up on all that stuff too, and I was like, I hope I'm not the only person like this.
No, I fucking love that shit. I loved, like, Welcome Back, Cotter, Taxi, I think might be my favorite sitcom of all time. Yeah, I don't know, like, the Bob Newhart era shit was all really good. Dick Van Dyke, Bernie Bro, by the way. I had an idea recently to do something as him. There's a show annually where stand-ups get together in, like, New York and L.A. and other cities, and, like, you kind of do a bit as, like, like, an old comedian or another comedian. And I might do this next year. I had this idea to do the Dick Van Dyke Show intro, like, so dressed up like him and, like, black and white, and then, you know, like, Trips Over the Ottoman. I wanted to do it just, like, Eric Andre or, like, Jackass style, where it's just ultra-violent, so you, like, trip over the ottoman and then you just fall, like, through a desk, like, backyard wrestling style, and just sort of elevate from there. But I'd have to take, like, stuntman classes and stuff to do it. I don't know, maybe someday. Anyway, back to the story at hand. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I started doing stand-up when I was, like, young. Like, I was, like, 18 or 19 the first time I did it. And, you know, I don't know. I was in a weird formative part of my life where it was, like, dropping out of college, really depressed, lived in a city that I didn't really know anyone in, and just sort of, like, reformed my whole worldview through it. So it's... this is an inextricable part of my adult brain, and I can't really, you know, it wouldn't go away if I quit comedy. I'm kind of one of those freaks that's been doing it since they were a kid. And, you know, I think I was into it because, like, around that time, I was getting bored of trying to make music in a punk band that isn't good, and I'm not good at playing music, so I'm kind of uninspired, and I just had, like, a reconnection with the comedy thing because around that time, I don't know how old you guys are. I think I'm a little bit older than most of the people that I'm hanging around in the comedy world and the podcasting world these days with. So to date myself, I think I started doing comedy around the time that, like, Patton Oswalt and the Comedians of Comedy were kind of on the come up and were, like, new and hip, and they were the counterculture to the Bush presidency, and everything was... it's interesting, we came all the way back around. Everything was kind of like it is now with everyone hating Trump, but a lot of people just don't remember because there's this big buffer of the Obama presidency in between these two things. So there was, you know, there was ideas floating around, not so much about comedy being like that much of a fucking weapon or whatever, but it's definitely a little bit more punk than you know, than it certainly was before that, where it was just weird, cheesy 80s comedy, and a little bit more than it was after that during the Obama years, where it's just navel-gazy, like, personal identity stuff.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's so weird. It's almost like the Bush years are, like, the lost years now that were wiped from everyone's mind, because I see, like, people trying to, like, rehabilitate Bush and be like, oh, well... He was so much better than Trump, and he's sort of like the aw shucks character of Republicanism now. Yeah. And I'm like, no, this dude was horrible. We bombed people and it got the Patriot Act because of him. I'm like, this dude doesn't deserve rehabilitation. Even if Trump is worse than him, he just doesn't deserve to be rehabilitated.
Well, does anyone does like? Why are we rehabilitating people? What's wrong with these fucking people? Trump is like, I know this is like a conservative term. I don't lend a whole lot of credence, but that like Trump derangement syndrome thing that Trump people talk about, where they make fun of people that are just driven insane by Trump. You're giving a lot of credence to their dunk on you when you act like this. I mean, we're getting like to a point where. I think that liberals would vote for someone worse than Trump just to beat Trump. Like, it could be, like, evil or, like, double Trump or something. And they'd be like, well, as long as it's not this Trump that I've fixated on for 4 years and fucking hate, then, you know, it's worth it because you gotta get rid of him or whatever. It kind of singularly occupies a really interesting space for people.
Yes. Seems as though that's kind of what we got with Biden.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I mean, more and more shit is... I'm talking about Trump now. More and more things are coming out about Biden. But, yeah, it's getting to a point with him where it doesn't really matter what he did as long as he's not the guy. But anyway, to, I guess, get back to what I was talking about, yeah, that's like what... I've been thinking about that a lot. That's when I started comedy and then somehow lived through all of Obama and then now... Trump, and I think comedy's meant a lot of different things to a lot of different people throughout that time, and you know, I'm trying to stay on top of like where it should go next and what it should be, because I think that comedians sort of fall into the quicksand really easily, and the worst thing you can kind of do is become stuck in a gear that you're comfortable in, that you like, you know, and then that's how, you know, in no time you'll look down and realize you're Nick DiPaolo and you're yelling about PC culture or something if you're not on top of your shit.
So the thing I notice about a lot of comedians and a lot of people that are into comedy, it's like very easy to get stuck in this like mentality of like, well, I grew up on Bill Hicks, so Bill Hicks is the greatest ever. And it just becomes like some weird, you know, I like Bill Hicks, but it becomes like very cultish and sort of like stuck in the 90s type thing. Yeah. And I think it's better when like we're constantly evolving.
Well, if you really learned something from Bill Hicks, you would learn to evolve in the way that he was evolving in that moment in the 90s, which means that you functionally would be continuing to evolve. You're really, you know, you're like a bad Christian or something if you, not to make such a Bill Hicks-esque fucking joke about it, but, you know, you're one of those people that's like tragically misunderstanding the thing that you worship if you like him so much that you're still telling his fucking jokes. There are a lot of dumb Bill Hicks guys in comedy. They're, I think, becoming lesser and lesser because, I don't know, maybe they're just turning into Stanhope guys or something. I mean, people still are stuck on stuff like that, but, Hicks, I think, is, you know, important, but, God, I mean, that shit isn't, like, gut-bustingly funny anymore unless you're, you know, really weird and stuck in the past. It's just, like, clever, you know?
You know, Stanhope's the one that I probably get stuck on way too much. I grew up on, like, Stanhope in my, like, college years. Like, that was, like, my comedian. I know you opened for Stanhope, I believe. What was that experience like?
It was cool, man. I mean, Stanhope's awesome. He's, like, also got a lot of annoying fans, obviously, as a lot of awesome things are wont to have. And I don't know. He's been a really interesting figure in my life and my career because, you know, I was hella into him when I first started, and he is somebody that people idolize because he's a big iconoclast, and, you know, he's really interesting because he is an intellectual guy and, you know, knows his history and stuff, and so he took his understanding of, I don't know, of society or of capitalism or something, and he sort of was an early person to forge a new path as a comedian in terms of like not doing these like clubs that forced you into bad relationships and stuff. But the thing is he was really into libertarianism for a long time. So I think that that kind of turned from DIY like punk type shit into DIY compound bunker type shit. And then also just into us being a small business owner. but you know, all that aside, I mean, yeah, he's a great comedian. He's at least interesting, even if I don't always agree with him. He's funny as shit. And, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was a big fan of his. And when I was younger and, you know, making my bones as a comic and working in bars and stuff, I mean, it was fucking, you know, it was an incredible experience to get to open for him when he came through Austin. And, you know, it was like one of the best shows of my early stand-up career and stuff. And, you know, it was really cool. I mean, he's a, for whatever you think about it, he's not a fucking politician. I don't know why I'm trying to, like, you know, nail him against the wall in terms of having been a libertarian and stuff. But he, whatever you think about all that, I think where he's coming from and where a lot of his points of views are based are, you know, that he likes people and that he definitely likes comedians, but he does something that comedians do, which is they treat comedians as the only worthwhile people on earth. There's a lot of tribalism in comedy, but I mean, it does feel good to be a part of that. When I opened for him, I remember he watched my set and he was like repeating my material back to me and stuff. And that always feels good, you know? But nowadays he's, you know, out in Bisbee and, I haven't run into him in a long time. I work with some comics that aren't in his like circles. And, you know, some of them are my best friends and some of them fucking hate me. So that's just how it goes eventually. But, yeah, now I think he's a really interesting person. And, I feel a little bit more, I don't want to like become sound egotistical and be like, well, he's an equal now, but I definitely am not like, someone who would cut off my right arm to go talk to the guy. I'm just like, all right, this is another interesting part of the landscape that I'm dealing with as, you know, a comedian and Somebody's got their own fucking small business.
Yeah, I was going to... The only thing I would add to it is I've always found him interesting in interviews because he can be, like, very different from, you know, the Doug Stanhope he plays on stage. Like, I think people underestimate how smart he is, and I think that happens with a lot of comedians. They're sort of, like, seen as the jester character when they're doing stand-up, but a lot of the times that sort of jester type character is just an amplification of like the true person, and there's sometimes a line between the two.
Yeah, I don't know, that dynamic gets, it folds over on itself a million times over. I mean, a lot of people, I'm has dancing around just fucking naming somebody, but there's like people in his circle that, you know, will go overly intellectual and literally use the jester metaphor to sort of, you know, overblow this idea that I mean, we all get it, you know, like, okay, the comedy can sort of like Trojan horse messages into situations where it normally would be less receivable or whatever. Like, we all kind of get that, I think, comedy heads. That's not, you're not blowing anyone's mind by putting it out there, but it is interesting that there's a dynamic that sort of plays in further and further in on itself. And like, he's kind of interesting because I don't know, I think his fans do think that he's smart, and they, you know, some of them that what he's doing on stage is the smart part, and some of them are like, no, like you're saying, like he's kind of being a little bit goofier about it on stage, and that he's smarter off the stage. And, you know, this is all interesting because it plays into just like what the fuck you're doing when you are a stand-up. Like, what, you know, are you a personality that's sort of for sale? Are you giving a sermon up there? I mean, what the fuck is really going on? Sometimes you're just making good points and it's not really evoking. Laughter isn't the first task you have at hand. I think about it a lot because I think humans just kind of have a natural predilection towards gathering in groups like that and, you know, having one person sort of lead things for a minute. And stand-up is this, you know, it's hilarious how it came about. I mean, it came out of, I guess, vaudeville and storytelling and the oral tradition. And then through, like, old smoky, you know, backroom mob lounge hangouts and stuff. And then eventually in the 80s, and it's just this, like, weird strip mall situation where it became really, really monetized and everyone was trying to do it. And now it's just sort of left over. There's kind of this vestigial practice that doesn't really need to exist. And all these dumbass, you know, young middle-class kids now want to do it. And you kind of look at it sometimes and go, what are we actually doing? You know, why are we all so addicted to the dopamine or serotonin blasts that you get as the comic from being up there, and also the one you get as the audience from being the crowd and sort of letting go for a minute? It's really bizarre.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always told people, I know you're sort of in that same sort of space as Chapo and Cumtown within the sort of, I guess people call it like the dirtbag left sort of podcasting scene, the comedy left podcasting scene. I always tell people, you know, guys like Jake, in a way I'm envious of them because I've never been, like, that funny guy. Sometimes I feel like I'm, like, too serious about stuff. And, like, I really wish I was more of, like, the person that could, like, let loose a bit. So I think you guys have something very special when it comes to that, comedians. Because, like, some of us are just, like, caught in, like, nerd theory world. And, like, ah, this happened in 1957 with the history of the left. And it's, like, it's kind of lame on the part of people like me to be so obsessed with, like, little details and whatnot. Sometimes I just wish I could make people laugh more.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I am doing my own podcast and I'm like, oh, this is like, there hasn't been a joke in this the entire episode. I'm just doing history or something. And I wonder, is it deceptive or should I be doing this thing that everyone sort of imagines is the purpose of comedy in propaganda? Should I just be using it to dress up these points? That always bothers me, though. I don't really know if that's exactly what comedy should be or has to be all the time. I think it's an arrogant way to look at yourself as a comedian, you know, this person that's, like, tricking people into being better people. That's a real liberal way of looking at comedy that, like, those people drive me fucking crazy standing on stage talking about, you know, punching up or whatever. But, like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if this means something about my, like, you know, my inherent, like, DNA or something, or if it's something that I've just completely, like, fried my own brain into being, but I can't help it, at least nowadays. I'm like this because it's a reaction that I have to the absurdity or whatever of the fucking news and the moment we're living in. I couldn't stop if I tried, and I don't mean that in a good way. I mean it's a disaster. I feel addicted to interacting with stuff this way. Sometimes I feel like it's a big op or something, like they're just, you know, just trying to keep us distracted with Twitter or something by making, you know, all these news stories come out, at the very least with spin on them that makes them as ridiculous as possible. But, you know, I also think it's important, the dirtbag lefty thing, which, God, I don't know, fucking, I feel weird claiming that. I also feel weird not claiming that. It's kind of a mess, the drama and politics of whatever the fuck that's supposed to mean in this moment. So take whatever I say about that with a grain of salt, but I think there's an important thing to it right now, which is that it's serving a purpose, which is to attack, like, the center from the left, which didn't used to be a thing, you know? I mean, for so long we lived with just the Daily Show and the TV telling you, you know, these Republicans are assholes and you've done a good job if you recognize that and you're a good liberal, you know, vote Democrat and all this stuff. And, you know, that festered. The center really kind of rotted and fell out, and that needs to be fixed. So I'm not saying comedy does that, but it doesn't hurt. It makes the process a little bit easier of criticizing those people.
Think it also just, I think it keeps people's spirits up in this time of, well, I don't know. Sometimes I just want Donald Trump to come out and be like, this is all a performance act. This is performance art, and obviously I'm being controlled by the Illuminati. Not that I believe in the Illuminati, but I that would be less surreal than the current news cycle.
Yeah, you know? it's interesting because, like, God, I don't know. Sometimes I get carried away thinking about this sort of stuff because, like, he is a comedian. Like, something happened. We're at the logical end of a cycle of, you know, allowing ourselves irresponsibly to have this, like, cable news thing run rampant and to create this Gramscian cultural hegemonic sort of brainwashy thing. And everyone just kept letting it going because it's profitable, and if you're a consumer, it's, like, easy to trick yourself into thinking, you know, watching your Rachel Maddow or watching your Tucker Carlson or whatever is, like, you doing research or whatever, you know, as an adult when you're overworked and bored and despondent and you just want to take in media passively. And, like, everyone let this shit, like, lay around and get weirder and weirder and turn into something that now we have to fight against and, like, take care of in the form of specifically this one guy who came out of it, who is, you know, like a kind of husk of a human being. It seems like he doesn't have a lot of brain cells kind of left, and he's just running all these various programs and sitting around and watching, you know, TV, like, all day, every day, and just letting that sort of shit get into his head and motivate where he's coming from. So, like, I don't know. The whole thing to me really rings like a haunted house like story. Like, there's kind of a lesson in it, like, you shouldn't have built this shit on a, you know, burial graveyard or whatever. I think we're getting our comeuppance, and I think that's why we're getting, like, I think it's kind of why the horror films of right now are, they all kind of have that going on, like that, like, I mean, Us, I guess Jordan Peele's Us was kind of explicitly about that. But when you look at, like, I don't know, like these interesting kind of satanic-y films that have come out in the last few years, kind of in the Trump era and the late Obama era, commenting on maybe on the Tea Party with, like, The Witch and, you know, Hereditary and stuff like that. There's a real vibe, there's a real mood going on right now that, to me, made me think, as a comedian, I guess, after Trump got elected, like, oh, you should probably eat your fucking vegetables right now if you want to understand any of this, and, you know, and be a comedian about it, and be, like, somebody who isn't sinking in the tar pit, like I was talking about. I don't know why people, like, I mean, I get it, it's just, you get stuck, and you get lazy, and you get despondent, but, like, I don't know why people aren't responding to everything going on in the world right now with, like, curiosity. It's fucking weird. We're living in the weirdest shit possible, you know?
No, I completely feel you on that. I like the horror movie analogy, by the way. I think we need President Ash from Evil Dead at some point. That would be a little bit less surreal. Bruce Campbell is president. That's another thing I wanted to ask you about was, you know, I know, so you do stand-up, but I always tell people when it comes to movies, I've always said to people, you know, people say like a Bruce Campbell or like a comedy actor like that, that it's not like as good as like high dramatic actors that can cry on cue during a film. And I'm like, I actually think that comedy is a lot harder to do than most like over dramatic sort of theatrical acting. I think people underestimate it. Comedy as an art form.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, comedy and horror are both really interesting to me because they are genres. And so they both get, like, if you look at, like, the way they're treated in terms of film by the Academy and all that bullshit, you know, they're both treated as lowbrow by these people who consider themselves to be the most important people on earth because they make dramas. And, you know, dramas are like, fine and good. And I, you know, I love a good serious film or whatever. But, yeah, I don't know. It's really interesting the way we have this concept of lowbrow and highbrow art and how it relates to this leftover Victorian era caste system of what we consider to be lowbrow and highbrow people. And, you know, if you're somebody who makes one or two or both of those things or whatever, comedy or horror or whatever the fuck, you make blaxploitation films, you make these things, these genre things, then you're underappreciated what you're doing, and that's fucking fine, who cares about that. What's also cool is that you can kind of reach higher heights in those specific genres, and, you know, I don't know, like a good example of this is in horror films and shit, a lot of times they'll test out newer, like, practical effects or special effects and stuff like that. But then after they're tested in these lowbrow, you know, poor people, dumb people realms, then you'll see it a year later incorporated into fucking, you know, Birdman or whatever. And then they'll go, oh, this is incredible, right? And so you never get appreciated for having been the person who pioneered that shit, like that era or whatever. And so a lot of that happens in comedy too, in that way we're talking about with the whole like fucking jester thing, you know, if you're doing your job well as a comedian or whatever, at least as we understand it in this, like, you know, Gramscian cultural manipulate-y, you know, way, it's one of those things where if you're doing your job well, then no one knows you're doing it, and they'll underappreciate you. Maybe they'll hate you. Maybe you're Jesus. I don't know where I'm going with this.
Well, I was just going to add, I think we're really on the same wavelength with like comedy and horror, because I've made that comparison. I always tell people, I'm like, comedy and horror are actually, well, I've always been into horror movies, and that's how I got into a lot of comedy stuff too. I think there's a similarity to comedy and horror in that they both require really, really great timing. Because for a movie to be a good horror movie or a good comedy, you have to have really great timing to make people either laugh or jump out of their seat and be scared. And that's, like, really hard to do. People don't realize that's difficult. That takes a certain, like, level of, you know, technical skill.
That's the other thing that they have in common and that makes them different, really, from drama, is that they both invoke a physical reaction. So you can pretend like you've got a really heady movie, and you know, no one can see, because it's what happened. It happened inside. Maybe a drama might make you cry or something, but with comedy, it's great because you know whether something worked because people laugh. And horror, you know, you don't, whether something worked because people fucking scream or whatever. And then also, yeah, like, just to kind of beleaguer that point a little bit, like, you know, as a comedian, people in the fucking audience all the time will come up to you after a show. They'll be like, yeah, so that was great. Do you just make it up every time you do this? And you go, no, you know, I fucking say the same thing 100 million times over. That's what the show is. But, like, that means the show works, right? So, like, if you're good at comedy, if you're doing a good job as a stand-up, then people don't know how hard you worked on the thing, because the whole point was to make it look easy, you know, and, like, casual. Weird how it works.
Do you, I'm just curious, so have you ever had the experience that every comedian, I guess, has had of hecklers? Because I always am curious how different comedians deal with hecklers.
Yeah. I don't know. When I was younger, a worse comedian, I got angry a few times at a heckler. I was trying to make a tape one time, and I was working all fucking day, and I needed to get this tape to try to apply for a thing where you tour colleges and you make, like, pretty good money doing that shit, like, way more than I was making. And I think a guy heckled me, like, a real drunk guy came in with just, like, you know, a plastic bottle of vodka and, like, some, you know, weird chain smoky biker girlfriend, and they just wouldn't shut up. I remember going off on him, and it wasn't funny, like, it was bad, and I thought I was gonna be Bill Hicks, right? But
yeah, they weren't. Were they yelling Freebird?
I mean, basically. And I was trying to make a tape, so I was like, you motherfucker, you just cost me $1,000. So I remember really losing it on that guy. But no, I think a heckler interaction is I don't welcome it. It's annoying, but, like, it can be cool. Like, I mean, it's cool. It's like watching a volleyball go back and forth or something. If, you know, if you see somebody really nail it, because it does something that I like in comedy, which is it makes something happen in the moment, which is what is supposed to be happening anyway. So the thing you're alluding to, and the thing you're at least pretending to do when you do stand up, and so many comedians are just robots. You know, so many people hate it because they're like, you should respect me, and I don't feel like you should respect me when I'm on stage. I think it's pretty stupid that I did this with my wife and then I'm a comedian, and it's insane that people give me money to do it. So I try not to get that fucking thing where I'm like, you know, you need to know that comedians hate this or whatever. I don't give a fuck. You throw shit at me, I don't care. I got heckled at one point last year by a woman, and then we just ended up making out after the show. It was crazy. That's probably the best heckler interaction I've ever had. I don't know. I gotta take it or leave them, I guess, hecklers.
So, Casey, you've been quiet through a lot of this. I know you wanted to ask about a certain incident that happened with Jake and one of our government agencies. Casey, you want to take it from there?
So, did anyone apply for the sombrero, or I saw the tweet after looking it up through the Spiked article, and I was like, holy shit, I can understand why they visited you. That's still pretty bullshit.
So for my listeners that are living under a rock, you were, you got in trouble with, I guess, the Department of Homeland Security after a joke about ICE on Twitter?
Yeah, I was, you know, workshopping some jokes on my Twitter account, and I happened to kind of come up with this riff about Cinco de Mayo, because I find it exhausting. I'm a mixed person of Mexican descent from Texas, you know, there are various things that people will call that, Chicano, Tejano, whatever. White people will just call me white. I don't know. Race is really complicated. But, these sorts of issues affect my life. And ICE is something that makes me very sad. The concentration camps are something that makes me very sad. And they're something I think that should be done away with. And so I was trying to juxtapose this point between, you know, the reality of how terrible that is that's happening, and the weapons with which liberals choose to fight them, which seem to be mainly, you know, chastising people about cultural appropriation, which is a thing that I find very funny. And I find it funny because, like, I don't know, the sombrero thing is, like, not a sacred ceremonial, like, it's not like a Native American headdress. It's just like a dumb hat that you're supposed to get drunk and put on and stuff. But, like, you see people, like, yelling, like, you know, the hat is sacred or whatever. So I came up with this bit where I was just like, what if we just, like, let somebody wear the hat if they killed an ICE agent? Like, problem solved for everyone. And, you know, that's...
Do people really get mad about the... do they say that wearing a sombrero is cultural appropriation? And are all the people who make that criticism, are they, like, white people?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, at least in spirit, they are white people. But, you know, there are, like, people that are... I mean, whiteness is a complicated thing. It's not just the color of your skin. Like, and Latin shit is a complicated thing. I mean, you know, Mexico was colonized by the Spanish, and then there was a caste system that went all the way from being indigenous through, you know, being mestizo, being all the way up to being just a Spanish person. And so because we live in America and race is understood to be, you know, specifically through the lens of, like, our, you know, our main racial conflict, which was, you know, Caucasians and African-Americans, Africans, you know, that we took from Africa, I think people don't really quite get that, like, the answer is not either. It's really complicated. There are people that are like that, like, Latinx or whatever, but, like, they're often, like, white, you know, from Mexico, and rich is the main thing. And nobody understands class in America either. So, like, you know, there is this thing, and it's, you know, also race is such a fucking hot, like, third rail issue for a lot of people. This doesn't get talked about a lot, and it certainly doesn't get talked about by people who feel like they don't have license to. So at least use, you know, whatever position I have to talk about this. Like, I mean, you have, like, these Ana Navarros and, like, you know, these fucking what's her face, the lady that did that Venezuela video about how we should invade Venezuela. You have a lot of white Latin people in America who move here, and then they're the representatives of, you know, Venezuela or Cuba or somebody, some place that has, like, a socialist past, right? And there's this parallax. Oh, okay, to use the fucking word here, a parallax distortion. I don't even know if I'm using it right, but there's a distortion of perception where those people, every Cuban you know in America, every Cuban in Florida will tell you that fucking, you know, they hate Castro, right? But it's because all of the Cubans that hate Castro left, mostly because they're rich, right?
I always say that to people. I'm like, because I have family in Florida, and they're always like, how can you... you know, be sympathetic to socialism. I talked to all these Cubans that came over, and I'm not, like, dismissing any of the Cuban immigrants and their views on Castro, but, like, ultimately we're only hearing from them. What about the people that stayed in Cuba? We don't hear about that.
Yeah, it's, like, not to dismiss them, but at the very least you should hear from everyone, and it seems like people are often, like, all too eager to go, well, I just talked to three Cuban people, and they're all from Florida, so that must mean that this means all Cubans feel this way. And they go, no, those are the people that say, when they say they fled Castro, they mean they fled him taking their money, not that they were put in the, you know, the you know, sugar fields and stuff. And that also happens. All this is really complicated, but... the reason I'm describing this is because, you know, you also get Latin people who get really serious about the cultural stuff, but I have a sneaking suspicion that those people are well-to-do, or at least middle class, and are getting this stuff from, like, academia, from college, and, like, you know, I was just talking to a friend of mine about this the other day, but, like, the Latinx thing is something that, like, it's not only for white people, but it's a white thing, and, like... you know, if you work in a restaurant, you have, like, a, you know, a fuck, you hang out in the back with, you know, the Latin dudes that are hired to wash dishes and work in the kitchen and stuff more often than not. Those people are never like, oh, excuse me, Latinx. Like, those, I fucking, you'd say that to those people sometimes and they'll go, like, what the fuck are you talking about, you know? So this woke stuff is kind of silly, you know what I'm saying, in comparison to, ice. And so, you know, I made this whole joke about it, and then fucking Homeland Security came to my apartment the next day. and then I, you know, had a weird conversation with them. I got off fine, but I do have a government file, I think. And a funny story about this, actually, that I forgot for whatever reason to include in, like, you know, when I told this on, like, Chapo and shit like that. But I used to have a job where I recapped TV shows for the New York Observer, and it was when Kushner owned it. It was real weird. But this is just a job that in, like, 2015, every writer had. You would just get paid to, like, you know, summarize and comment on what happened on prestige TV that week or whatever. And pretty good gig. But I got it through a friend, and I successfully wrote some troll articles through the Observer, which I had a good time doing. But I would also just write about TV shows. And when you do that, you know, you don't get to write about, like, Game of Thrones or whatever if you're new. That's the person, the highest person on the totem pole gets to watch the good TV shows. So I had to watch, like, the bad ones. And one month I had to watch season 5 of Homeland on Showtime. And
oh, my God, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it sucks. And I had never seen the first 4 seasons of it. So I had to cram. I just had to hang out and watch 4 seasons of Homeland. And, you know, I mean, I was having Homeland dreams and stuff, and just, you know, just taking it all in and just go, God damn, is this worth this, you know, this job where I watch right on TV. And, yeah, it sucks. It's a TV show that it's really interesting. There's a Pentagon program where they work with Hollywood, and they, you know, have a symbiotic relationship where, like, movies and TV shows like that are really well researched in terms of, like, what the characters actually look like. So they look like the people in Homeland Security, the actors. They have the same uniforms and stuff. It helps them with propaganda, and it helps the studios with funding, right? So it's a quid pro quo there. So, like, that's why, like, Top Gun happened and all of these weird, you know, pro-military, you know, movies and TV shows, and, like, I mean, during the Bush era, like, all the torture porn stuff, like 24 and shit.
Or even movies, since you mentioned Top Gun, I always think of Top Gun and 300 as being, like, the most, I don't know, the movies like that are ultimately extremely homophobic and homoerotic at the same time, and I don't know how they're able to do that. I'm just like, what? It's a mindfuck.
Yeah, I know. I mean, without even going, like, the hacky direction and just going, like, well, these guys are actually, you know, they want to fuck each other. I mean, it's just, like, the confusion of masculinity is just hilarious. It doesn't know what to do with itself in this modern world. And, like, yeah, we don't know whether we want to fucking fight each other or fuck each other, I guess, man. But the Homeland thing's funny because, like, I just had this, like, fever dream. I had to watch these fucking actors, and it was so well-researched that when I woke up and, like, you know, these people were banging on my door, and I wanted to go see what the fuck was the matter, I opened the door, and there's these fucking 4 or 5 people, and they're dressed exactly like Mandy Patinkin and What's-Her-Face and, like, all my characters from my TV. So I was like, oh, you're here. Like, I know you. You know, for a moment, it didn't occur to me that it was fucking real. And I think that honestly gave me an edge in this situation because, you know, you read about COINTELPRO and stuff, or you read about this shit happening to people who have a reason to be much more legitimately scared. Like, people did get put in, like, jail and prison for a long time over stuff like that around that time, too. And, I mean, you know, let's be honest, usually people with darker skin than me, you know, it's scary. And a lot of the reasons that it's scary is because a lot of those people he had their back against the wall because they had, like, kids in their house or something, you know? But I'm a fucking comedian. I don't have anything. I don't give a shit. I have a death wish, you know? And so they open the door, and I'm like, well, I don't have any kids. I don't have any pets. I don't even have any drugs in the house. I mostly just drink alcohol. Like, you know, there's nothing that would normally turn this into a situation where they could leverage anything against me. So I was, you know, just like, what's up? And, like, you know, they just came in, and I just hung out, and they asked me about the ice joke, you know, and I sort of explained to them, like, I'm a fucking comedian, you know, like, I know you know that because I know you looked me up. How the fuck do you know where I live, you know? And we just had this really interesting, candid conversation, and I started to realize that, like, everything was going to kind of, you know, just diffuse. And they asked me an interesting question, which is they asked me, like, do you want to ask us anything? You know, I was like, what the fuck? Like, we had a job interview? What is this? You know? Like, they're such nerds. They're such Boy Scouts that they couldn't help but, like, ask that question. So I was like, yeah, you know. I had been kind of involved in, like, Black Lives Matter stuff like that and reading about the cops for a long time. So, like, you know, certain ideas were swirling around in my head. And the main thing was just, like, what, like, from your point of view, the person here in defense of ICE, what is ICE? Like, what does it do, you know? Because it seems to me to just be this thing that came up for a really bad reason during Bush, was sort of, like, secretly kind of, you know, low-key pumped up a little bit during Obama, and now it's, like, in a really bad position because we have Trump in office, and, you know, and it's nothing more than secret police for ethnic cleansing. And he goes, oh, that's, you know, it's a good question. What we do in ICE is we fight human trafficking, you know? And I thought it was really interesting because, like, human trafficking, the language of human trafficking, the image, the fucking specter of it is what they use. I mean, in a lot of, like, white supremacist circles, you know, all that, like, protect our white children shit is, you know, they're going to come steal your daughter and put, you know, put her into sex slavery or whatever. They also use that to just disenfranchise sex workers. And I had been reading about a lot of that shit because there was, like, a whole Sesta Fosta thing going on. And so I looked into it. I was like, man, this is, like, really interesting to know not only, like, what they're using to propagate this stuff for their own devices, but also, like, or for their own purposes, but also they might believe this shit, too, you know? But it's still bullshit, though, because ICE doesn't actually, like, fight human trafficking, like they're saying. They are, you know, a kind of bureaucratic agency that has to, in the same way that, like, police just manipulate, like, what crime is even defined as in order to make it appear that they're fighting more crime, ICE, like, manipulates what human trafficking really is defined as in order to just justify their own existence, because they're an organization that gets money from the government and stuff. So, like, they would do stuff like if you are a you know, an undocumented person or a sex worker or something, and you get in your own car and drive across state lines, that's human trafficking. Because you just trafficked yourself, right? That's fucking bullshit, right? But that leads to these statistics that then they go show, you know, fucking Helen Lovejoy or whatever, and she screams, "Oh my God, the children!" You know, and that's how this stuff gets around, that has consequences that fucking affect people. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I wanted to get back to something real quick before we start to wrap up. You mentioned the whole woke thing. I don't know, like, I think that we do have to address issues like racism and sexism and gender issues in conjunction with class, which I'm sure you also believe that. But, like, what gets me is I had a person recently, because I've done a few shows on police brutality, and they said, well, I can't really talk about police brutality since I haven't experienced it. And that would be insulting to people that experienced it. And that's, like, the kind of wokeism that, like, just – it blows my mind, because then you can't actually address any real issues if you're saying, well, since I didn't experience this thing, I can't, like, stand up for the people who have experienced it, or I can't be an ally to them. It's fucking bizarro world to me.
Yeah, and it's important not to get bogged down in just railing on, you know, wokeness, because then before you know it, you're just a reactionary, right? And reactionary is someone who's defined by just having a response to this stuff. And, you know, that stuff is ginned up. Like, the Koch brothers fuel reactionary, anti-woke, anti-PC literature and stuff in order to use that to their advantage. And so, you know, really, I think, as a comedian, but also just as a fucking person right now. If you really want to understand the world and be able to criticize it, you have to kind of be fighting a war on both fronts. Because, yeah, I mean, for the most part, identity politics to me are not bad. They're insufficient, and they're often used in bad faith. And those two things are the bad thing about them. And for that matter, I mean, certain stuff coming from the other direction, freedom of speech and, you know, and even fucking as far as to talk about some of this shit that ICE is talking about, there is something in there that, you know, you can't be purely reactionary against and you can't entirely dismiss because, like, I'll be right back. Somebody's ringing the doorbell. Hold on. Okay, I'm back. Sorry. So I had a package delivered and everyone in this apartment is podcasting right now. Because we're in Brooklyn. So, man, I was really getting to a point there. But the point I was saying was that, like, the point I was trying to get to was that, you know, I mean, to paint a picture of the other side of the coin here, human trafficking does exist and should be fought against. But the problem here is, like, a bad faith use of that language, right? So, not to be like a both sides or person, but that is the nature of being a comedian. Everything deserves criticism.
Well, I mean, if ICE wanted to stop human trafficking, they would have gone after Jeffrey Epstein.
Right, of course. It's crazy. He was right there. But yeah, I can't remember why I got interrupted by the fucking UPS guy. What the hell were we talking about?
Oh, the whole woke verse. I guess some people are saying, like, dirtbag left or class reductionism. I don't know. Like, I think people oversimplify everyone's views. So I kind of get annoyed with the online debates about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the people within the dirtbag left are annoying, and then also the people commenting on it are annoying, because that thing is happening on both of these, you know, scales. And, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's really fucking frustrating. And plus, all of this stuff is happening through this communication technology that is both a blessing and a curse. And it's all really fucking exhausting, man.
I feel like social media, in ways, has turned everything into the Jerry Springer show. There's like this off-Broadway play that I'm a fan of called Jerry Springer in Hell, in which, yes, Jerry Springer actually is put on trial in hell. And yeah, I feel like that title sums up my views on social media and just the whole political landscape in general. We are Jerry Springer in hell because all we do is, like, argue and strawman each other and call each other names like we're still in high school. And I hate that about social media.
Yeah, the ringleader, Jerry Springer. He's such a great metaphor for everything. That guy's fucking hilarious. Got arrested for writing a sex worker a check, like a real class act. I don't know where things are heading as a comedian, or, you know, where reality is heading, and the social media thing is scary. I don't know what's going to happen with this shit. This is especially now with us all being fucking forced inside. Like, this is very much like the Videodrome new flesh, you know? I guess this is happening. There's no fighting against it anymore. And, you know, I think they're really, really fucking, I just watched Videodrome the other day and I kind of got it in the head, but I think, like, or on the mind, I kind of think, like, yeah, we might be entering this new phase where we're inextricably linked to this technology, and we're just going to kind of feel a little sick all the time from it and not really have the stuff you get from sunlight and human actual communication and looking into people's eyeballs.
You know, have to say you're my new favorite guest, because Videodrome is one of my favorite movies. And I think you may be, like, only the second person to have ever mentioned Videodrome without my prompting. Actually, first person without my prompting. So you are now the coolest guest I've ever had on Parallax Views simply for mentioning fucking Videodrome, the greatest James Woods, David Cronenberg movie ever. And it makes me so sad that James Woods has become a crazed reactionary madman now. But I guess it's, like, mildly entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fitting, I guess, but yeah, that movie fucking rules, man. I watched it recently, and I don't know if I was just on, like, a weird kick that day, but I was like, man, this is kind of about like everything that's happening right now with the you know, social media and technology and shit. I don't know if you intended it, but that's such is the nature of art, right? Who knows whether it even matters if they intended it for it to be about that. It's just a metaphor.
Yeah, it's funny. I know Cronenberg based it on this like urban legend that was going on around in Canada. There was this urban legend in Canada that the like small TV stations there were being used as a mind control experiment. So he's like, I'm going to make a movie based on that. And I'm like, wow, things don't change much because we have all those conspiracy theories today, you know, like QAnon and Pizzagate type shit.
Yeah, in Russia. Man,
oh my god, the Russiagate stuff needs to end.
Those people, like, it's so funny now that those people are the people that don't believe this woman, Tara Reid, because, like, you believe everything. I mean, this Russia, you're going out on a limb to, like, believe everything they ever tell you about Russiagate, but now you don't believe a woman who said she was, you know, sexually assaulted? Incredible. Incredible the mental gymnastics we're able to do.
We did that under the Clinton years too. I mean, the Juanita Broderick and all those women that came out, and regardless what we think of their politics, I mean, Broderick, a lot of people have said now, was probably a credible accusation. And I'm like, people threw her under the bus because they're like, oh, we can't attack Lord Bill Clinton. And I'm like, it's the same thing with Biden now.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever seen Hypernormalization?
I love me some Adam Curtis, so yes.
I would say that's an, you know, well, I mean, I'm not going to fucking pat myself on the back for saying this because it's been said plenty and someone else said it first. But, like, you know, it's an apt comment on the nature of how subjective truth is right now and, you know, maybe an interesting explanation of how it got that way. But it started back then, so it makes sense that, you know, all the way through the 90s and stuff, in terms of, like, these kind of media narratives and cable news and just what the fuck the Clintons were doing with in terms of manipulating truth, you know, going around saying one thing in one state and one thing in another state just to try to win an election. Like, yeah, at least as far back as them, we've got off on this kick where reality is choose your own adventure, and social media is kind of making that worse. It's also making it really weird to be a comedian because the audience doesn't believe a homogenized thing anymore. They don't believe in a homogenized reality anymore.
There is no consensus reality anymore.
Yeah, so there's no point in trying to play a really huge crowd. You can only sort of just try to gather your own people that believe in the thing you believe. And every one of those people, every one of those little cells or syndicates thinks that they're the people that are actually right, you know. Everyone's susceptible to it. Even those of us that are actually on top of this, you can't help it. It's just the nature of your mind to, like, kind of go, like, okay, the dirtbag left is right about everything, and, like, you know, other people are crazy or whatever. I don't really know what the future of being a comedian really is either. I think it's kind of just, I think it, there's no more monoculture, so there's no more, there's not going to be like a Carlin just sort of reigning over everything and breaking it down the way that happened. I think we're just going to be like these little micro things now.
You know, I was going to add something real quickly if I could, and that's you mentioned the Russiagate stuff, and it just came out like a few weeks ago. I didn't see much coverage of it outside of a few like major news outlets, but then it quickly got swept under the rug, and they were saying that the Steele dossier, which was the whole thing that a lot of Democrats were pushing about, Putin has compromise on Trump, and this dossier shows how Putin has a tape where Trump is being peed on by a bunch of escorts. And I'm like, you know, to each their own. But the funny thing is they found out, now they're saying that dossier was Russian disinformation itself. And I'm like, this is the level of fucking, you can't make the jokes up anymore. They sort of write themselves. We live in The Onion.
the dossier was Videodrome. And if you see it, it'll, you know, make you go crazy. It's videos of people peeing on each other coming from Pittsburgh. Wait, that's where you are. Pittsburgh is where Videodrome comes from in the movie. Holy shit.
Oh my god.
This whole thing
is simulation is breaking down.
Hey, Casey, is there anything you wanted to pick Jake's brain about before we close out the show?
Not really. I think we kind of fleshed out how comedically stupid this moment in time is, and I don't want to piss on it any further.
And I think we've also learned that movies like Videodrome, and I would add to this, as the great Roddy Piper once said, They Live was a documentary. And that's basically how I feel about all this shit at this point.
Yeah, They Live fucking rules.
Don't you just love how all our commercials start and end with, we're in this together now?
Yeah. We're in this together. Buy a lot of shit that you don't need to impress people you don't like.
Like, I'd appreciate it more if they just said obey and buy.
Jay, yeah, I know.
That brings one more thing to mind. I'm curious, since Casey mentioned it, have you seen, like, all these weird celebrity videos that are coming out now? Like, Gil Gadot and a bunch of other celebrities making videos, like, of, they did a video cover of Imagine, where they each sing a line, and they're like, we're in this together, and then you have Arnold Schwarzenegger sitting in his hot tub with all his alpacas saying, don't go outside, relax like I am. And yeah. I'm like, I don't have a hot tub, motherfucker. It's really weird, this celebrity stuff right now. Ugh.
I think that a lot of that stuff actually happened in the first sort of weeks of coronavirus, and I think we're seeing less of it, because what happened is they made that the fucking Gal Gadot-ass Imagine video with... I don't even know who the fuck those people in that video were anymore. Like, those are supposed to be the most famous people on Earth, you know? And then, like, yeah, you saw the Arnold Schwarzenegger video and the Ellen DeGeneres video, but then, like, a week later, you know, it came out that Ellen was, like, busting unions and shit like that, and I think that they got a pretty negative reaction from the internet, which is interesting, right? Because things kind of migrated from TV to the internet, because a lot of what drove TV ratings and stuff like that is, like, drying up. So, for example, live audiences, right? Like, Comedy Central right now is dumping all of their shit onto YouTube and, like, their own channel on the internet and stuff, because I don't know exactly the ins and outs of why, you know, what's causing them to crash, but, I mean, stand-up is obviously based on having fucking people in the room to laugh at shit, right? And so, you know, I mean, that also is kind of, like, why, you know, them forcing in Biden is really bad, because this whole situation caused him to have to campaign on the internet and not be able to do these, like, huge live events and stuff. It looks really bad for him to try to do, like, events on TV right now. And, you know, Biden's an old man who doesn't understand the internet. Bernie was pretty good at the internet, and so the two things are kind of pitted against each other, and, like, and I think, I guess what I'm getting at here is that, like, Biden doesn't do well on the internet. I don't think celebrities really do either. They kind of have, like, social media followings, but the reason that celebrities are always, you know, railing about cancel culture and, you know, famous celebrities all hate their audiences is because the audience has never been able to talk back to you, but now it can, because you're putting shit on the internet, and there's comment sections and stuff on Twitter. And so I think that, like, we're seeing less of those videos, and eventually they're just going to start kind of hiding from us. And that language of we're all in this together is getting reacted to in a way that it wouldn't if it was just a fucking commercial. But yeah, it's very obvious that we're not all in this together. And I think that, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm hoping for this. Maybe it's not happening as much as I'd like to imagine, but I think the mask is kind of coming off, and people are going to be like, as people are dying around you more and more, you're going to be less, you know, susceptible to go, oh, but Gal Gadot said something nice to me, you know?
I think it's kind of funny you brought up Biden's absence, too, because I've already been seeing articles in some of the lefty, if you could call it that, establishment press about how Trump getting, like, 9-1 media coverage over Biden is actually good for him. because it'll highlight how stupid Trump is.
Yeah, just like last time.
And it's like he already has a freaking perfect shield for that.
I've already heard, like, people within the Democratic establishment saying, what we should do is keep Biden off TV and off the internet as much as possible. And I can understand why they're saying that, because I just don't think there's much going on with Biden. And I mean, I don't want to get into the whole, like, oh, Biden obviously has dementia thing. But, like, the way he communicates and some of the things he says, like, he's a gaffe machine. And I just don't know that if that's – he makes a good vice president, because we don't always have our eyes on the vice president. You know, we always had our eyes on Obama.
You could just stuff him in a cabinet somewhere and just forget about him for like 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that type of person, when you put him in the presidential position, they just look kind of ridiculous. And I don't think it's going to work out real well.
Yeah, I mean, vice president says something weird, it's like funny, you know? But like, oh, he's a counterweight. He needed Obama to be like counter that out, you know? Obama was a great speaker, whatever the fuck, you know, we think of his politics or whatever. But Biden, I don't know. I don't want to make any predictions and look dumb or whatever, but I mean, part of the reason I think he's not going to win, and this is not as necessarily important as the material realities and conditions that cause people to become people that already don't like him or like Trump or something like that, or just don't give a fuck about any of this. But like, you know, we are in the fucking new flesh, the Videodrome thing, and Trump is good at that. His base is meme people and forum people and shit like that. And Biden, doesn't fucking have it. It's like embarrassing. So we're in a really bad situation where they are noticing that, like, he can only do damage to himself if he appears in public. So he needs to just sort of not really exist and just exist as this idea that is the guy who isn't Trump.
I think that's a perfect summation. Biden's campaign slogan should be not Trump, because that seems like what they're running him as. Jake, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If you can, real quick, let my listeners know how they can listen to Pod Damn America and your other podcasts. I really dig what you're doing with Pod Damn America. We have some crossover. We both had Mike Gravel and John McAfee on. And John McAfee's a very interesting man when I had him on. So, ooh. And Mike Gravel, people make fun of Mike because he's sort of an eccentric character. But dude's actually really smart and has a lot of heart for someone that is like, I think he's like 90 or 91 right now. And he knows what he's talking about. So I like Mike, and I'm glad you had him on your show as well.
Yeah, we got a lot of flack for that Bloomberg comment he made. But but yeah, I think you're right. He's a cool guy. He's the coolest 91-year-old I know, man. McAfee, no comment. He was terrifying. But
okay,
yeah.
So you felt the same way I did. Because when I had McAfee on, I'm like, maybe he's gotten like a raw deal, and maybe that documentary like took advantage of the fact that he's like a weird anti-government gun nut. And then when I had him on, I'm like, I could totally see why people would think this man killed someone in Belize. I'm not saying he did, but I can see why people would say that.
Yeah, I don't know. I had a real moral conflict about putting him on, and then we kind of just had a meeting, and we're like, well, if we just fuck with him, he seems like he'll just fuck with us back, and then that'll just be a found art sort of situation, and then we'll just fucking move on, and it'll be, you know, I'm not promoting John McAfee, but also he doesn't need my promotion. Anyway, yeah, if you want to hear another crazy interview with him, we did one. If you want to hear about what my conspiracy theory I came up with about how I think that Joe Biden has lead poisoning, we did an episode on him a while back. You can find all this on my podcast called Pod Damn America, and my other one's called Why You Mad, which is where I get into like stand-up comedy and theory and stuff like that. It gets a little bit more into the Jules Deleuze and all that bullshit. With my friend Luisa Diaz. Both of those are on iTunes and fucking Stitcher and Spotify and all that crap. And they have Patreons, and that's, you know, the new currency. And my handle on everything is Feral Jokes, FeralJokes. It's an anagram for my name, Jake Flores. And I think that's all I have to promote since I cannot tour anymore because we can't go outside.
Well, I always like to tell people that I like to end on a positive note because I'm cheesy like that. Anything you can say to lift people's spirits? I mean, you're the comedian. You have to make people laugh and make people happy. I don't know. I'm kidding. But
long live the new flesh, I suppose.
I mean, Videodrome was a hell of a movie. Thank you again, Jake Flores.
Thanks, man.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Hope you enjoyed our conversation with Jake Flores. Be sure to check out the Pod Damn America and Why You Mad podcasts. And, of course, drop me a line with your thoughts about this edition of Parallax Views on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. And if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon. Just released some new Patreon content, including a video version of Parallax Views, The Week That Was, in which I, yours truly, eat a burrito while Casey explains why the Empire in Star Wars was evil, and everyone claiming otherwise is a revisionist of Star Wars history. Hey, sometimes we like to have some fun on the show. And you can support me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. If you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon. It would help me out greatly. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.